Among the messages of farewell composed by 16-year-old Lady Jane Grey during the week before her execution in February 1554 was a letter addressed to her younger sister Catherine, written on the blank leaves of her Greek Testament.
I have sent you, good sister Catherine, a book, which though it be not outwardly trimmed with gold, yet inwardly is of more worth than precious stones. It is the book, dear sister, of the laws of God, which shall lead us to the path of eternal joy. It will teach you to live and learn you to die. It will win you more than you would have gained by possession of your woeful father's lands, for by it you shall be inheritor of those riches, as neither the covetous shall withdraw from you, nor the moth corrupt. Live still to die, that by death you may purchase immortal life. Deny the world, defy the devil, and despise the flesh. Delight only in the Lord. Be steady in your faith, yet presume not. And desire with St. Paul to be dissolved to be with Christ, with whom even in death there is life.
Catherine Grey was 14 when her father and sister were beheaded, and although she remained steady in her Protestant faith, she proved incapable of profiting from the rest of this pious exhortation. Prettier than Jane, but with none of Jane's formidable intellectual equipment, Catherine was a frivolous, scatterbrained little creature who took an entirely normal, healthy interest in the world and the flesh. A very ordinary girl, born into an extraordinary position. Her tragedy, like her sister's, was her Tudor blood. Nearly 40 years before, the Princess Mary Rose, younger sister of Henry VIII, had made a runaway marriage with Charles Brandon, Duke of Suffolk. The title passed to their daughter, Frances, and her husband, the parents of Jane, Catherine, and Mary Grey. When Henry VIII made his will, he took advantage of the powers granted him by Parliament to nominate his successors, and ignoring the claims of the Stuart descendants of his elder sister, bequeathed the crown to the Suffolk line, in default of heirs from his own children. Just how deadly this legacy was to prove had already been demonstrated by the Duke of Northumberland's abortive coup d'etat in the summer of 1553. For 9 dreamlike days after the death of Edward VI, Jane Grey had been Queen of England, while Mary Tudor became a hunted fugitive. King Henry's elder daughter wasn't vindictive. Having once established her right to her father's throne, she was ready to be merciful. She even spoke of setting the usurper free. Then came the Wyatt Rebellion. The Duke of Suffolk made a disastrous attempt to raise the Midlands, and Mary was reluctantly brought to agree that her cousin must die. Innocent though Jane herself might be, her very existence had come to represent an unacceptable danger to the state. Her father's behaviour had made that clear. The Queen, however, went out of her way to show that she bore no malice to the surviving members of the family. The widowed Duchess of Suffolk was received at court, and Catherine Grey was appointed maid of honour, with an allowance of £80 a year. Catherine's life now became easier in several ways. She was no longer subject to her parents' bullying discipline. The Queen was kind to her, and she'd made a friend of one of her fellow maids of honour, the Lady Jane Seymour. This friendship was to have a far-reaching consequence for Catherine, as she now proceeded to fall in love with Jane Seymour's brother, Edward, Earl of Hereford. Hereford himself later described how their story began.
I first determined to be a suitor to the Lady Catherine in the time of Queen Mary. As I remember, the same time that the Lady Jane, my sister, was brought sick in a horse litter from the court to the Duchess of Somerset, my mother's house at Hanworth. The Lady Catherine then being there also under my mother's government. I first moved the Lady Catherine of my good will, born unto her, meaning of marriage with her, at Hanworth. I did never impart this matter to my mother, but she, perceiving familiarity and good will between us, often admonished me to abstain from the Lady Catherine's company. Whereupon I answered that young folks, meaning well, might well accompany together, and both at Hanworth and also in the court, I trusted I might use her company, being not forbidden by the Queen's Majesty.
And there, for the moment, the matter rested. Harford may not have been entirely serious about marriage at this stage, and anyway the political situation was too unsettled to make definite plans for the future. They were both very young. It seemed wiser to wait a little. In November 1558, Queen Mary died. She was succeeded by her sister, Elizabeth. A new era had begun, and Catherine Grey's position changed. She remained at court, but her life was no longer so easy or so pleasant. By the terms of King Henry's will, she was now the heiress presumptive, and as such had become a figure of international importance. The first few months of Elizabeth's reign were a time of hectic activity, and it wasn't until March the 24th, 1559, that the Spanish ambassador, Count de Feria, found time to mention the subject of the Queen's heir in a letter to King Philip.
I have forgotten to write to your Majesty that the Lady Catherine, who is a friend of mine and speaks confidentially to me, has told me that the Queen does not wish her to succeed. She is dissatisfied and offended at this, and at the Queen's only making her one of the ladies of the presence, whereas she was in the privy chamber of the late Queen, who showed her much favour. The present Queen probably bears her no good will. I try to keep the Lady Catherine very friendly, and she has promised me not to change her religion, nor to marry, without my consent.
De Ferrier was not an especially percipient man, but on this occasion he can perhaps hardly be blamed for failing to realise that the demure and apparently confiding Lady Catherine was cherishing some very definite plans of her own regarding marriage. She'd been seeing a good deal of the Earl of Harford recently, and love did again revive betwixt them. The young couple now decided that they'd take steps to try and get official approval for their engagement as soon as an opportunity presented itself. But Catherine and Harford were not the only people with ideas about her future. Her status as heir presumptive was by no means unchallenged, the chief rival candidate for this honour being 16-year-old Mary Stuart, Queen of Scots, brought up in France and now married to the Dauphin. The King of France, in fact, was of the opinion that his daughter-in-law had every right to be occupying the English throne at that moment, and she and her husband were openly quartering the royal arms of England with their own. Spain viewed these pretensions with disfavour, and had begun to consider possible counteraction. The King of France was unexpectedly killed in a tournament in July 1559. But in August, Thomas Chaloner, English ambassador to Spain, writing from the Netherlands, thought it worthwhile to pass on to Queen Elizabeth certain information received.
Robert Hoggins, an English gentleman here in the service of the King of Spain, lately came to me with this advertisement, that a little before the French king's death, the Spaniards, fearing his pretended titles for the Scottish queen, sought means to solicit and get into their hands my Lady Catherine Grey, whom further, as events should fall out, they might either marry to the Prince of Spain or with some other person of less degree, if less depended on her. By this tale they take her to be of discontented mind, as not regarded or esteemed by the Queen or of her friends.
The fact that the Queen of England and her heiress were not on good terms had been noted with interest by Spain, and in October Thomas Chaloner passed on another report from the same source.
As concerning the Lady Catherine, it is not certain whether Spanish determination has altered, since the King of Spain does not so much fear the French king that now is as he did his father. But had the late king not died, the matter would certainly have been put in practice, and these persuasions were used to show that it would be easy to be accomplished. The said lady was in the Queen's great displeasure, who could not well abide the sight of her. The Duchess, her mother, did not love her, and her uncle would in no wise abide to hear of her, so that she lived, as it were, in great despair. She had spoken arrogant and unseemly words in the hearing of the Queen and others standing by, and it was hence thought that she could be enticed away if some trusty body spoke with her.
Catherine Grey might be dissatisfied by the Queen's treatment of her and be unwise enough to show it, but she wasn't interested in the ramifications of the European political scene. She had only one idea in her mind in the summer of 1559, and the obvious person to approach Elizabeth on her behalf was her mother, now married to a Mr. Adrian Stokes. According to Catherine's own account, the Duchess was ready to be helpful.
When the Queen's Majesty came to Hampton Court, the Earl of Hertford rode to the Lady Frances Suffolk, my mother, who lay at that time at the Charterhouse near London, and moved her to grant her goodwill that he might marry with me. Whereupon my mother sent to the court, willing me to desire leave of the Queen's Majesty to come and speak with her. So I did, and coming to my mother, she broke the matter with me, saying that now she had provided a husband for me, if I could like well of it, meaning the Earl of Hertford, and desiring me to frame my fancy and goodwill that way. Whereunto I was very willing, which my mother perceiving, she immediately, upon the advice of Mr. Stokes, devised a letter to be rough drawn for herself to write to the Queen's Majesty for her goodwill and consent to my marriage.
Young Master Adrian Stokes, who had once been the Suffolk's equerry, was clearly thrilled at being involved in such an important affair, and he corroborated Catherine's evidence on this point.
The Lady Frances declared to me that she thought the Earl of Hertford to be a very fit husband for her daughter, and required to know my opinion therein. I answered that I thought it good, if it should so please the Queen's Highness and her Honourable Council. Whereupon I talked with the Earl of Hertford, and advised him to make suit to such of the Queen's Majesty's Council as he thought were most his friends, to be a means to the Queen for him, for accomplishing of the marriage. The Earl liked this advice very well, saying he would follow the same, but whether he did so or not I know not. I further declared to the Earl that if he would make suit to the Council in this behalf, then the Duchess would write to the Queen's Majesty for her favour, and in very deed she required me to make a draft of a letter for that purpose.
But, unfortunately, before any of these hopeful plans could be put into operation, the Duchess of Suffolk became ill. She died on November the 20th, 1559, and her letter to the Queen was never written. Hertford was apparently so discouraged that he told Adrian Stokes he intended to meddle no further in the matter. Catherine moped about the court, beset by rumours of foreign kidnappers lying in wait for her, and obliged to serve a mistress she both feared and disliked. It would have been an uncomfortable predicament for any girl, but most of Catherine's troubles were to spring from the fact that she totally failed to appreciate the realities of her position, a position which inevitably set her apart, and which, in the tense political climate of the times, needed the utmost tact and subservience if she was to survive at all. Catherine had failed to take any warning from Jane's death. She also failed utterly to grasp the nature of the Queen, on whom she was dependent. Elizabeth, even in her 20s, was a formidable figure. One of the Venetian ambassadors wrote,
"She lives a life of magnificence and festivity, such as can hardly be imagined, but nevertheless she insists upon far greater respect being shown to her than was exacted by the late Queen Mary."
Perhaps it's not surprising that neither Catherine nor Hertford ever considered a direct appeal to their glittering, enigmatical sovereign. Elizabeth, for her part, regarded Catherine Grey with a coldly suspicious eye, but she had responded with characteristic subtlety to the warnings received from Thomas Challoner. In January 1560, Bishop Quadra, the new Spanish ambassador in London, was telling his predecessor,
"The Queen now calls Lady Catherine her daughter. The feeling between them can hardly be that of mother and daughter, but the Queen has thought it best to put her in her privy chamber, and makes much of her to keep her quiet. She even talks about formally adopting her."
Catherine and Hertford continued to meet from time to time, but the Earl had begun to show ominous signs of interest in someone else. The whole affair might well have died a natural death, if Lady Jane Seymour hadn't decided to take a hand. Sometime in October, the court came to Westminster, and then, in Catherine's own words,
"The Lady Jane Seymour told me that her brother had to speak with me, and I was very willing to hear that motion, for I desired nothing more. It had happened a little before that time that I had quarrelled with the Earl of Hertford, hearing said that he bore good will to a daughter of Sir Peter Mutus. But when he came, the Earl told me that to avoid all suspicion, and because I should not think he meant to mock me, he would, if I would, marry me out of hand as soon as convenient time might be found for the purpose. And then should I be sure, and out of all doubts. I at the same time declared that I liked both him and his offer, and thereupon we gave our hands one to the other.
Harford's account of how he proposed and was accepted agrees on the essential points.
I did make my suit for marriage to the Lady Catherine in a closet of my sister's, which she had privately to herself within the maiden's chamber of honour, my sister and no other being then and there present with us. The Lady Catherine's answer was that, weighing well my long suit and goodwill borne unto her, she was contented to marry with me the next time that the Queen's Highness should take any journey and leave her and the Lady Jane behind.
So, in a spirit of optimism and bravado, apparently believing that their marriage would be accepted once it was a fait accompli, Catherine and Harford embarked on the one course of action most exactly calculated to infuriate the Queen and bring ruin on themselves. It was agreed that the ceremony should take place in the Earl's house in Cannon Row near Westminster Abbey. Lady Jane undertook to have a clergyman standing by, and Harford had a ring made for the occasion. This was a plain gold band, with a concealed spring opening five links, on which were engraved a verse composed by himself.
As circles five by art compact, show but one ring in sight, so trust uniteth faithful minds with naught of secret might, whose force to break but greedy death no wight possesseth power, as time and sequels well shall prove. My ring can say no more.
Between All Saints' Day and Christmas, 1560, probably sometime early in December, the Queen decided to go to Eltham for a few days hunting. Catherine and Jane were ready with their excuses. Catherine had toothache, and Jane, who was already consumptive, also presumably pleaded illness. As soon as Elizabeth was safely out of the way, at about 8 o'clock in the morning, the two girls slipped out of the palace by the stairs in the orchard and walked along the sands by the river to Cannon Row. The wedding ceremony was performed in Harford's bedroom, and afterwards, while Jane Seymour kept guard in another room, the new married couple went to their naked bed and had carnal copulation. 2 hours later, bride and bridesmaid were on their way back to Whitehall. Awkward questions would be asked if they failed to appear at dinner with the controller of the household. Catherine might have achieved her immediate ambition, but her altered status made little practical difference, and she and Harford still had to be content with snatched and furtive meetings.
From the time of my marriage till the death of the Lady Jane, I used myself with the Earl as his wife in my own heart, getting his company sundry times alone by the means of the Lady Jane, who did go with me to Cannon Row. And after the death of the Lady Jane, we had sometimes secret company by the means of a woman of my own, whose name was Lee, but who is now gone from me. I never procured this woman unto it, but she would of herself, when she saw my lord and I whisper together, withdraw herself out of sight and leave us alone.
And according to Harford,
I lay with the Lady Catherine divers times in the Queen's houses, both at Westminster and at Greenwich, nobody being privy thereunto, for her maidens would always go out when I came in. But I lay not with her any night time.
How long the couple intended to try to keep their secret, it's impossible to say. But it wasn't long before events began to catch up with them. Jane Seymour died in March 1561, and without her help, it was more difficult for them to meet. The accommodating Mrs. Lee soon became frightened. She asked leave to go home on a visit and never came back. Then the Queen decided to send Harford abroad as a companion to William Cecil's son Thomas, who was going to France to finish his education. This was an unexpected complication, to be followed by another, not so unexpected.
I first mistrusted myself to be with child before the death of the Lady Jane, and told her thereof, who answered that then there was no remedy but to make it known how the matter stood. The Earl himself said the like, and that we must abide it and trust to the Queen's mercy.
But whether the inexperienced Catherine had made a genuine mistake at that time, or whether she simply couldn't bring herself to face the consequences of her pregnancy, nothing was done. Harford, with the air of one who has done his best in trying circumstances, later testified,
"Neither at the time of my departure beyond the seas, and neither before, did the Lady Catherine discover to me that she was with child. I asked her divers times whether she were with child or no, and she answered always that she could not tell. I then said unto her that if she could precisely say that she was with child, I would not depart the realm. Otherwise I would."
He showed her his passport in the orchard at Westminster, and then told her that if she wrote to him telling him she was pregnant, he would not long tarry from her. Young Harford may have felt a certain guilty relief at the prospect of escaping, at least for a time, from a situation which was rapidly getting out of hand. But he did take one practical step towards his wife's welfare.
"About 6 days before my going beyond the seas, I did devise a writing with my own hand in parchment, sealed and signed with my own hand, wherein I did signify my intent was that the Lady Catherine should have and enjoy after my decease, for the term of her life, so much of my lands and possessions as should amount to the value of £1,000 by year for the maintenance of her estate. And this writing I delivered into her own hands."
Her husband went abroad in April, and now Catherine was entirely alone. She seems at last to have begun to realize something of the enormity of what she had done. She certainly received some ominous warnings.
"Mr. Secretary Cecil, in talk with me at Greenwich, did advise me to take good heed how I proceeded in familiarity with the Earl of Harford, without making the Queen's Majesty privy thereto. Another time, the Lady Marquess of Northampton, the Lady Clinton, and others did seriously advise me to beware of the Earl's company. But I denied both unto Master Secretary and the others that there was any such matter."
In July, the court went on a progress into East Anglia. There was now no question about Catherine's pregnancy, and she'd written to Harford begging him to return, but couldn't be certain if her letter had reached him. It was no longer possible to conceal her condition. Tongues were wagging. And on Saturday, August the 9th, she was finally forced to ask for help.
"I did disclose to Mistress Saintlow of the Privy Chamber both that I was married to the Earl of Harford and that I was with child. Whereupon Mistress Saintlow fell into a passion of weeping, saying she was very sorry that I had done so without the consent or the knowledge of the Queen's Majesty. The Sunday following, at night, I went to the Lord Robert Dudley's lodging and declared the same to him at his bedside, requiring him to be the means to the Queen's Highness for me."
Catherine could hardly have been more inept in her choice of confidence. The shrewd, hard-bitten Mistress Saintlow, better known as Bess of Hardwick, was the last person to involve herself in someone else's troubles. As for Robert Dudley, his feelings on receiving a nocturnal visit from a sobbing, visibly pregnant young woman are not difficult to imagine. As the Queen's acknowledged favourite, Lord Robert had many active and determined enemies. It was less than a year since he'd narrowly survived the hideous scandal of his wife's mysterious death. He had no intention now of becoming mixed up in anything even remotely questionable. He got rid of Catherine with more speed than politeness, and next morning went to the Queen with the whole story. Writing to the Earl of Sussex 2 days later, William Cecil remarked laconically,
"The 10th of this month at Ipswich was a great mishap discovered. The Lady Catherine is certainly known to be with child, as she saith, by the Earl of Harford, who is in France. She is committed to the Tower, he is sent for. She saith that she was married to him secretly before Christmas last. Thus is God displeased with us."
But God's displeasure was of less immediate importance to the Harfords than the Queen's. Elizabeth, not unnaturally, was furious. She never liked Catherine, but had always treated her fairly. Now the girl had repaid her with insolence, deceit, and perhaps worse. The Queen made her suspicions clear in a letter addressed to Sir Edward Warner, Lieutenant of the Tower, dated August the 17th.
"Our pleasure is that you shall, as by our commandment, examine the Lady Catherine very straitly how many hath been privy to the love betwixt the Earl of Harford and her from the beginning. And let her certainly understand that she shall have no manner of favour, except she will show the truth. For it doth now appear that sundry personages have dealt herein. You shall also send secretly for St. Lo, and put her in awe of divers matters confessed by the Lady Catherine, and so deal with her that she may confess to you all her knowledge in the same matters. It is certain there hath been great practices and purposes, and, since the death of the Lady Jane Seymour, she hath been most privy.
Anything which touched on the succession touched Elizabeth on her most sensitive spot. She hadn't forgotten, she was never to forget, her own experiences as a second person during Mary's reign, and of the intrigues which inevitably surrounded the heir to the throne. In the activities of the present heir, she'd caught a sulphurous whiff of treason. Catherine Grey's choice of husband had been unfortunate. The Seymour family had the reputation of being politically ambitious, and their connection with the royal house was uncomfortably close. If Catherine were to have a son, it would complicate still further an already complicated dynastic situation. The Earl of Hereford, therefore, soon joined his wife in the Tower, and the government's investigators proceeded to extract from them every detail of that strange hole-and-corner marriage in the house at Cannon Row. Edward Warner took Catherine through the early history of the affair and of her betrothal. Then he came to the wedding day itself.
In your ladyship's going to the Earl's house, did you see or meet with any man or woman, either at your entry or at any other place therein?
I met nobody between the court and the Earl's house, nor at my entry. The Earl met me at his chamber door, as I remember, and this was about an hour or a little more after the Queen's Majesty had departed for Eltham.
Mm. Were you and the Earl served with any banqueting dishes or drink on the day of your marriage? By whom were you served?
After the marriage, Lady Jane did offer me comfits, and there was beer and wine upon the cupboard. But I drank none, and saw no person that brought them in.
How long after your coming to the Earl's chamber was the minister brought thither?
As soon as we came in. The Lady Jane went forth, and after tarrying about a quarter of an hour, she returned and brought the priest with her.
What communication had you and the Earl in that space?
I do not remember what our talk was, but it was only such as passeth between folks that intended as we did.
Mm. How long was the priest or minister at the solemnization of the marriage?
Until such time as he could accomplish the service. But how long that was, I cannot certainly remember.
Did you stand or kneel?
At the time of the marriage, we stood. And at the time of the prayers, we kneeled. Our backs were towards the bed, and our faces towards the window, as I remember. And the minister stood with his back towards the window. The Earl of Hereford gave me a ring containing 5 links of gold, which he put on my finger, by appointment of the minister, and I have worn it ever since, saving only when I was sick.
Immediately after the ceremony, Catherine said, she and Hereford had gone to bed together and remained there for about an hour and a half, but no one had helped them to dress or undress. Warner then questioned her closely about the priest who had married her.
I never knew his name, nor did I ever know him before that time. He was a well-complexioned man, with an auburn beard, of a mean stature, dressed in a long gown faced with lambskin, and he wore no surplice. I think that if I saw him again, I could call him to remembrance.
In his own statement, Hereford confirmed Catherine's evidence with a little more detail.
The priest that married us was procured by my sister Jane, but his name I know not. We were married with such words and ceremonies, and in that order as it is set forth in the Book of Common Prayer, which book the minister brought with him. He was a man of mean stature, fair complexion with an auburn beard, and of middle age. He wore a plain gown of black cloth with a falling collar, such as the ministers used when they came out of Germany. I gave him nothing for his labour, but the Lady Jane, as she afterwards told me, gave him £10, which she laid out of such money as I used to give her toward her apparel and other expenses. I said nothing to him at his departing, but thanked him and bade him farewell.
The Earl's interrogators went on to put much the same questions to him as they had to Catherine.
How long was the minister or priest at the solemnization of the marriage? And how long tarried he in your chamber after he had made an end thereof?
He was more than half an hour about the ceremony, and departed as soon as he had done, the Lady Jane guiding him out. The chamber door was put to during the solemnization, and at the minister's departure the Lady Jane did open the door, going out afore him. No person remained with me and the Lady Catherine until the Lady Jane returned, which was within less than a quarter of an hour. She then, perceiving us ready to go to bed, withdrew herself, leaving us alone.
Did you or the Lady Catherine go first to bed? And who first rose out of the bed?
We went in manner both together, but I somewhat afore her, as I remember. I lay sometimes on the one side of the bed and sometimes on the other, and we arose nigh about the same time.
Who did help you and the Lady Catherine to dress yourselves?
No person did help us either to undress or to make ourselves ready after we rose.
Then how long was the Lady Catherine in tiring and trimming herself?
Not more than half a quarter of an hour, as I remember it. And then she went down to the water gate with the Lady Jane, and I kissed her and bade her farewell.
Did you have word brought you before her coming that there was a minister prepared for the purpose of marrying you?
There was no word brought me of the minister's coming, but the Lady Jane, my sister, assured me the night before, and divers times afore that, that whensoever the time would serve, there should be a minister in readiness.
Both Catherine and Harford repeatedly declared that no one, with the exception of the strong-minded and efficient Jane Seymour, had advised, counselled, or exhorted them to marry. The Earl's servants were questioned, but he'd taken the precaution of either sending them out on errands or giving them the day off. It transpired that William Powell, the cook, peering out of the kitchen door, had noticed the arrival of Jane Seymour and Catherine. Christopher Barnaby, a groom of the chamber, had actually met them on the stairs, but no one in the household admitted to having guessed what was happening. On September the 24th, while the investigations were still proceeding, Catherine gave birth to a son. The baby was christened within the precincts of the Tower, in the chapel of St. Peter ad Vincula, a location made unusual by the fact that the headless remains of both his grandfathers, two of his great-uncles and his aunt, were buried there. The most exhaustive inquiries failed to uncover any evidence of a plot involving the Harfords, although the Queen was still not entirely convinced and the witnesses were released. It was no longer a treasonable act merely to marry a member of the royal family without the sovereign's consent, so the government decided to attack the validity of the marriage. As the only witness to the ceremony was now dead, and the officiating clergyman had apparently disappeared without trace, this didn't present much difficulty, especially as Catherine was predictably unable to produce the one piece of documentary evidence she had possessed. According to Sir Edward Warner,
the Lady Catherine, being examined what deed she had received concerning any assurance of a jointure for her living from the Earl of Harford, saith that the Earl delivered her such a deed, being written in parchment. This, she saith, she put into a coffer, and with removing from place to place at progress time, it is lost, and she cannot tell where it is become.
A correspondent writing to Nicholas Throckmorton in Paris summed up the situation.
The Lady Catherine and Lord Harford agree upon the time, place, and company of their marriage, but cannot bring either witness or minister. They must either find out the minister or determine what the law will say, if it be a marriage or no. The matter lies chiefly, notwithstanding all determination, in the Queen's mercy.
But Elizabeth was showing no particular inclination towards mercy. At the beginning of 1562, she put the matter in the hands of the ecclesiastical authorities, and on February the 10th, she sent further instructions to Edward Warner.
Whereas the Most Reverend Father in God, the Archbishop of Canterbury, with others, have commissioned to examine, inquire, and judge of the infamous conversation and pretended marriage betwixt the Lady Catherine Grey and the Earl of Harford, our pleasure is that when the Archbishop sends to have either of the parties appear before him, you shall yourself take them as prisoners in your custody to Lambeth. You shall suffer neither of them to have conference with any person whilst they remain there, and return them in like manner to their places. for our will is to have judgment.
On May the 12th, the Archbishop gave judgment that there had been no marriage between the Earl of Hertford and Lady Catherine Grey. He censured them for having committed fornication and recommended a heavy fine and imprisonment during the Queen's pleasure. The culprits remained in the Tower, but there were certain compensations. Sir Edward Warner was a kindly man. He'd already allowed Catherine to have the company of her pet monkeys and dogs. Now he discreetly allowed her to have the company of her husband. He later justified himself by saying that, having once been over-persuaded, he thought there was no point in continuing to keep them apart. During the summer of 1562, Catherine and Hertford probably enjoyed the nearest approach to a normal married life they were ever to know. Even this was precarious enough, as a note written by Catherine to her husband during this period shows.
No small joy, my dear lord, is it to me the comfortable understanding of your maintained health. I pray God to let you sustain it, as I doubt not but he will. Though of late I have not been well, yet now I thank God pretty well, and long to be merry with you, as you do to be with me. I say no more, but be you merry, as I was heavy when you the third time came to the door and it was locked. Do you think I forget old forepast matters? No, surely I cannot, but bear in memory far more than you think for. I have good leisure so to do when I call to mind what a husband I have of you, and my great hard fate to miss the viewing of so good a one. Thus, most humbly thanking you, my sweet lord, for your sending both to see how I do, and also for the money, I most lovingly bid you farewell.
For a time the Hertfords seemed almost forgotten. But that autumn something happened which brought the whole problem of the succession into sharp focus again. As the Spanish ambassador reported toward the end of October...
The Queen was at Hampton Court on the 10th of this month, and feeling unwell, thought she would like a bath. The illness turned out to be smallpox, and the cold, caught by leaving her bath for the air, resulted in so violent a fever that on the 7th day she was in great danger, and her life despaired of. However, during that night the eruption came out, and she is now better. In her extremity, the council was almost as much troubled as she, for out of the 15 or 16 of them, there were nearly as many opinions about the succession. Some wished King Henry's will to be followed and Lady Catherine declared heiress. Others, who found flaws in the will, were in favour of the Earl of Huntingdon. Some would like the Queen of Scots, and others Lady Margaret Lennox, who is considered devout and sensible.
Elizabeth made a good recovery. But the crisis had shaken the English people and brought home to them just how much depended on her life. The immediate result was a renewed and frantic onslaught on the Queen to marry at once and name her successor. But apart from any personal preferences, Elizabeth's virgin state was her trump card in the game of international diplomacy, and was far too useful to be lightly discarded. Neither had she any intention of being forced into committing herself on the succession. Too much depended on who Mary Stuart, now widowed and back in Scotland, took for her second husband. Apart from this, Elizabeth was well aware of the danger of allowing any one religious or political faction to lose hope entirely. As long as the question remained open, a balance could be maintained. With her usual skill, the Queen succeeded in stalling the House of Commons. But the problem refused to lie down. Catherine Grey's following was not inconsiderable. She was pure English, a staunch Protestant, and had proved her ability to bear sons. Unfortunately for Catherine, she was shortly to prove this again. In February 1563 came the inevitable sequel to Edward Warner's indulgence, as Sir John Mason told Thomas Challoner.
The Earl of Hertford, having by corruption of his keepers had secret access by night to the Lady Catherine, she by his company hath brought a boy child into the world. The Earl has therefore been called before the council in the Star Chamber, and hath for that offence a fine set on his head of £15,000.
This fine, it was later reduced to £3,000, was for having deflowered a virgin of the blood royal under the Queen's own roof, for breaking prison by visiting Catherine in the Tower, and for having ravished her again. The Earl defended himself resolutely before the Star Chamber.
Being lawfully married to the Lady Catherine, who hath already borne me a fair son during the time of our imprisonment, I do not deny but that I have passed through the doors of the prison standing open to comfort her in her sadness and to pay my conjugal duty, of which I cannot repent.
But Elizabeth was really angry. That aspect of the Harfords' behaviour which she found most difficult to forgive was their apparently cynical disregard for the authority and prestige of the Crown. Now, instead of showing any contrition for what they'd done, they had repeated their crime. The Queen's temper was not improved by the fact that there was widespread sympathy for the young couple, who were held to have been sharply handled. Their romantic story had captured the public imagination, and their inability to prove their marriage was felt to be more their misfortune than their fault. John Mason had written to Cecil on January the 28th,
"There be abroad, both in the city and sundry other places of the realm, very broad speeches of the case of the Earl of Hereford, some following their lewd affections, and some others of ignorance make such talk as liketh them, not letting to say they be man and wife, and why should man and wife be let from coming together? These speeches and others, as I am informed, be very common."
Mason's own opinion of the Earl of Hereford was succinctly expressed.
"There is not a more outré youth, I speak French for lack of apt English, within the realm. Neither one that better liketh himself, nor promises himself greater things. He should be made to learn himself. If a good part of his living might answer some part of his offence, and the imprisonment therewithal continue, it would make him to know what it is to have so arrogantly and contemptuously offended his prince."
Neither Hereford nor his wife were to be in any doubt in the future about what it meant to have offended their prince. Nor was Edward Warner, who was dismissed from his post and temporarily incarcerated in his own prison. Catherine's second son was christened Thomas, with two warders acting as godfathers. But there were no more meetings, secret or otherwise, between the parents. The plague was very bad that summer, and by August more than 1,000 people a week were dying in London. The Queen agreed that the Harfords should be moved, and the Earl and the elder child were released into the custody of his mother, the Duchess of Somerset. Catherine and the baby, Thomas, were sent to her uncle, Lord John Grey, at Pergo in Essex. Lord John received explicit instructions from the council about how his guest was to be treated.
"The Queen's Majesty, having consideration that the Tower of London is environed with infection of the plague, for the danger that might ensue, hath been pleased of her compassion to commit the custody of the Lady Catherine to you, her only uncle. Her Majesty, notwithstanding, hath commanded us to write to your lordship that her pleasure is that the said lady shall remain with you and your wife as in custody, not to depart from you until Her Majesty's pleasure be further known. Neither to have conference with any person without knowledge of your lordship or your wife. Which Her Majesty meaneth the Lady Catherine should understand as some part of her punishment, and therein to try her disposition how she will obey. And for our parts, we heartily pray your lordship to have regard that she use herself in your house with no other demeanour than as though she were in the Tower, until she may attain more favour of the Queen's Highness. And so we pray, your lordship, let her plainly understand."
John Grey hastened to assure William Cecil that his niece was indeed a penitent and sorrowful woman for the Queen's displeasure, and Catherine wrote herself from her uncle's house on September the 3rd,
"Good cousin Cecil, after my very hearty commendations, with like thanks for your great friendship showed me in this my lord's delivery and mine, I cannot but acknowledge myself bounden and beholden unto you. So I beseech your further friendship for the obtaining of the Queen's Majesty's most gracious pardon and favour towards me, which with upstretched hands and downbent knees from the bottom of my heart I most humbly crave. Thus, resting in prayer for the Queen's long reign over us, the forgiveness of my offence, and the short enjoying of my own dear lord and husband, with assured hope through God's grace and your good help, I bid you most heartily farewell.
In spite of the hint that Elizabeth might presently be inclined to relent, Catherine seems to have felt this new separation from her husband very bitterly. As John Gray wrote to Cecil in September,
"The thought and care she taketh for the want of her Majesty's favour pines her away. She eateth not above 6 morsels at the meal. And if I say to her, 'Good madam, eat somewhat to comfort yourself,' she falls a-weeping and goeth up to her chamber. If I ask her what the cause is she uses herself in that sort, she answers me, 'Alas, uncle, what a life is this to me, thus to live in the Queen's displeasure. But for my lord and my children, I would to God I were buried.'"
Lord John may have disliked his niece, but her misery seems to have moved him to genuine pity. By December he was seriously worried about her, and wrote again to Cecil.
"The augmenting of my niece's grief in the want of her Majesty's favour enforces me every way to declare unto you her woeful state. This 3 or 4 days she hath for the most part kept her bed, in such wise as I thought once I should have been driven to have sent for some of the Queen's physicians, and I never came to her, but I found her weeping, or else saw by her face that she had wept. Wherefore, good cousin Cecil, for the love which ought to be betwixt Christian men, and for the love wherewith God has loved us, procure by some way or means her Majesty's further favour towards the Lady Catherine. For assuredly, she never went to bed all this time of her sickness, but they that watched with her much doubted how to find her in the morning. She is so fraughted with phlegm by reason of thought, weeping, and sitting still, that many times she is like to be overcome therewith. If she had not careful women about her, I tell you truly, I could not sleep in quiet."
In spite of this alarming report, Catherine was able to write to Cecil again on December the 13th.
"What the long want of the Queen's Majesty's accustomed favour towards me hath bred in this miserable and wretched body of mine, God only knoweth. If it should any long time thus continue, I rather wish shortly to be buried in the faith and fear of God than in this continual agony to live. I must confess I never felt what the want of my prince's favour was before now, and if it be by your good means once obtained, it shall not fail again by my default. So mindful, God willing, shall I be not to offend her highness."
These and other cries for mercy continued to fall on stony ground, and the troubles of both uncle and niece were aggravated by the fact that Catherine appears to have been virtually destitute. When she was first committed to the Tower, some household furnishings had been allocated to her out of the royal wardrobe. But according to Edward Warner, writing to Cecil in September 1563,
"Sir, as to the stuff my Lady Catherine had, I wish it were seen. She has used it now 2 years full, and most of it is so torn and tattered with her monkeys and dogs as it will serve to small purpose. Besides that, she had one other chamber furnished with stuff of mine, the which is almost all marred also. I would be loath to have any more business with my Lord Chamberlain, but if it please you to move a word to him, that I may quietly enjoy it, I trust he will be so content. If I have it not, some of it is fitter to be given away than to be restored to the wardrobe again, and that I justify with my hand."
Whether or not Sir Edward was allowed to enjoy what remained of the government issue is not recorded, but it can hardly have been worth much. It had been well used even before Catherine's monkeys and dogs got to work on it, and included 2 footstools covered in green velvet on which Henry VIII had once rested his sore leg. When Catherine arrived at her uncle's house, she had no money, no plate, and according to John Gray, was so poorly furnished that he was ashamed to let Cecil have an inventory of her possessions. Lord John reluctantly supplied the deficiencies, but he balked at paying for his prisoner's keep, and the Queen was soon complaining about his expenses. Lord John retaliated by sending a detailed account to Cecil. The weekly rate for my Lady of Hereford's board, her child, and her folks amounted to £6.16.8. As this included 8 servants and even 5 shillings for the widow who washed the baby's clothes, it seems reasonable enough. Elizabeth, who was never averse to having it both ways, now decided that the Earl of Hereford should be made responsible for Catherine's maintenance, and he was ordered to pay the sum of £114 to the Greys. Hereford took this opportunity of making another plea for forgiveness, and wrote to Robert Dudley, now Earl of Leicester, in March 1564.
As always, so now, I crave your lordship's especial means to her majesty, that we may be unburdened of her intolerable displeasure, the great weight whereof hath sufficiently taught us never again to offend so merciful a princess. My trust is that God will bless your lordship's travails, and by your means turn the sorrowful mourning of us, her majesty's poor captives, into a countershine of comfort, for the which I rest in continual prayer.
But whatever hopes the captives still cherished that the queen would eventually forgive them, suffered a severe setback that spring. On April the 27th, William Cecil was writing to a friend,
"Here is fallen out a troublesome fond matter. John Hales secretly made a book in the time of the last Parliament, wherein he hath taken upon him to discuss no small matter, viz. The title to this crown after the Queen's Majesty. Having confuted and rejected the line of the Scottish Queen, he hath made the line of the Lady Frances Suffolk, mother to Lady Catherine, only next and lawful. He is committed to the Fleet for this boldness, and is like to go to the Tower, especially because he hath communicated it to sundry persons. My Lord John Grey is in trouble also for it. Beside this, John Hales hath procured sentences and counsels to be written by lawyers from beyond the seas, maintaining the lawfulness of the Earl of Hertford's marriage. This dealing of his offendeth the Queen's Majesty very much."
Elizabeth was not appeased by John Hales' assurance that his only thought had been to promote the cause of a Protestant succession against that of the Catholic Mary Stuart. Her rage simmered for the remainder of the year. And in December, Cecil remarked that the Queen's displeasure still continued towards my Lord of Hertford and the Lady Catherine. John Grey had died in the autumn, and Catherine was now in the charge of Sir William Peter at Ingatestone in Essex. Thanks to the efforts of her would-be champion, her chances of being reunited with her husband and elder son looked as remote as ever. In the spring of 1565, the pendulum swung again. Elizabeth was so annoyed by Mary Stuart's marriage to Lord Darnley that the King of Spain was afraid she might nominate Catherine as her successor after all. Now that Mary was no longer a protégé of France, she'd become more acceptable to Spain than the Protestant Catherine. Nothing came of these fears, however, but in the summer, an element of black comedy entered the story. On August the 21st, William Cecil wrote tersely to Sir Thomas Smith,
"Here is an unhappy chance and monstrous. The Sergeant Porter, being the biggest gentleman in this court, hath married secretly the Lady Mary Grey, the least of all the court. They are committed to separate prisons. The offence is very great."
The current Spanish ambassador, Guzman da Silva, passed on the news to King Philip, adding a few more details.
"The Queen had in her house a sister of Jane Grey, who was beheaded for claiming the crown, and of Catherine, who is in prison. She is little, crook-backed, and very ugly. And it came out yesterday that she had married a gentleman named Keyes, Sergeant Porter at the palace. They say the Queen is very much annoyed and grieved thereat."
In fact, this grotesquely pathetic attachment between diminutive 19-year-old Mary Grey and the enormous gatekeeper, a middle-aged widower with several children, was the last straw as far as Elizabeth was concerned. The succession problem continued to erupt from time to time. In October 1566, Guzman da Silva was reporting that all the heretics were furiously in favour of Catherine's claim. Parliament was in session that autumn, and on November the 13th, da Silva wrote to King Philip,
"The Queen, seeing they were determined to carry on the discussion about the succession, sent them an order not to do so. But as the members thought they had full liberty to treat upon matters beneficial to the country, they greatly resented this. It appears they claim the right to proceed in the appointment of a successor to the crown, and in this case, although the Scottish Queen has a large party in the House of Lords, it is thought that Catherine would have nearly all the members of the lower chamber on her side. It seems, therefore, that everything tends to disturbance. But I do not believe the matter will be carried forward."
Da Silva was quite right. Catherine remained a prisoner, and appears to have given up all hope of release. By the end of 1567, she was in the final stages of tuberculosis. She was now at Yoxford in Suffolk, in the custody of Sir Owen Hopton, and it was there at 9 o'clock in the morning of January the 22nd, 1568, that she died. During the course of a long and articulate deathbed scene, she begged Owen Hopton to make her final requests to Elizabeth with his own mouth. She prayed once more for the Queen's forgiveness and went on,
"I must needs confess. I have greatly offended her in that I made my choice without her knowledge. Otherwise, I take God to witness I had never the heart to think any evil against Her Majesty. I beseech her to be good unto my children, and not to impute my fault to them, for in my life they have had few friends, and fewer shall they have when I am dead, except Her Majesty be gracious to them. And I desire Her Highness to be good unto my lord, for I know this my death will be heavy news to him, and that Her Grace will send liberty to glad his sorrowful heart withal."
She asked Sir Owen to give some tokens to her husband for her. She handed him a ring with a pointed diamond, which Harford had given her when he proposed in Jane Seymour's closet at Westminster, and the ring with 5 links of gold which he had put on her finger in the house at Cannon Row 7 years before. The knot of secret might, already effectively broken by the Queen, was now severed permanently. Catherine's death caused little stir. A pawn had been removed from the political chessboard. The players adjusted their disposition slightly and went on with the game. To Elizabeth, it meant one less potential threat to her security. To Harford, whatever his personal feelings may have been, it held out a promise of release, and 2 years later he was at last set free. He was to survive Catherine by more than half a century. He married again, but never gave up his fight to have his first marriage recognised and his son's legitimacy established, a fight he eventually won in 1606. He died in 1621 at the age of 82, but not before he'd seen his grandson maintaining the family tradition by secretly marrying and trying to elope with yet another claimant to the throne, Lady Arabella Stuart. Elizabeth has often been criticised for her implacable severity to Catherine Grey. But to the Queen, engaged on a lifelong struggle to keep the monarchy strong and England safe from civil war and foreign invasion, personal happiness, her own or other people's, was inevitably a matter of secondary importance. Neither was it an age which placed overmuch importance on individual earthly happiness. Foolish, obstinate, reckless Catherine undoubtedly was. Her life and death made no impact on the course of history. But her attempt to claim the right to some personal happiness, foredoomed as it was to failure, has a certain forlorn dignity. Neither she nor Harford qualify as high romantic or tragic figures. All the same, their love story deserves a place, however small, in the record of human suffering.
You've been listening to A Knot of Secret Might. It was produced by Richard Wortley and compiled from contemporary sources by Alison Plowden, with narration by Stephen Thorne. Lady Catherine Grey was played by Neris Hughes, Hartford by Sean Arnold, Queen Elizabeth by Maddie Head, and William Cecil by Rolf Lefevre. Further cast included James Thomason as Sir Edward Warner, Elizabeth Proud as Lady Jane Grey, Walter Hall as Deferia, Charles E. Stidwell as Thomas Challoner, with Gerard Green as Quadra, Godfrey Kenton as Soranzo, and Hector Ross as John Grey.